Europe's got a plan to deal with the debt crisis.
Haven't we heard that before?
I believe we have. From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. Today is Monday, October 10th.
Coming up, this year's Nobel Prize in Economics goes to two Americans for their work on how policy impacts the economy.
Netflix abandons plans to spin off its DVD by mail service.
And all the news that's fit to talk about from the gaming company Zynga.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Vast Conference, conference calls that give you clarity, professionalism, and flexibility all at a low price. For two Vast Conference calls free with no commitment, go to vastconference.com, promo code Marketplace.
European leaders met over the weekend and say they're going to come up with a comprehensive plan to deal with the European debt crisis by the end of the month. The plan aims to get ahead of the crisis by pumping capital into European banks.
Let's get some analysis now. Julia Coronado is off today. We are joined instead by Adolfo Laurenti, deputy chief economist with Mesirow Financial. He is with us from Chicago. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Adolfo, from what you know about this plan that Merkel and Sarkozy have come up with or are going to come up with, does it sound like it's going to be a solution?
Well, at least it looks like a promising solution since it tackles two different but related problems, the one of the Greek debt and banks' solvency. We know that Greece has too much debt to pay it back, so it needed to restructure, possibly to an orderly managed manner. But at the very same time, we also know that the European banks will suffer losses because of a default of Greece, and so government needed to resign themselves to the idea of a bailout plan by injecting some capital into the banks, very much like in the U.S. we did 3 years ago with the TARP.
Right. But we've known about the problems in Greece. We've known about the problems at the banks. The government in Europe, the governments have sort of come up with varying solutions over the last couple of years. Why do you think it'll work this time?
I think it's different this time because the two problems are finally related together. If you go back like 6 months ago or 1 year ago, Europeans were adamant in denying the need for a recapitalization of the banks, the injection of capital, and they were also very adamant in denying the possibility of a Greek default. This is a turn of 180 degrees, and now both proposals are on the table.
Adolfo Laurenti, deputy chief economist with Mesirow Financial, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, it's not just Greece that'll be making sacrifices under the new plan. France and Germany will too, as Caitlin Carroll reports now from Berlin.
Since the crisis began, France and Germany have each been asserting their own agendas. For its part, France wants its banks to have easier access to bailout funds. Germany, on the other hand, wants banks to take more write-downs on the value of bad loans to countries like Greece. Fabian Zuleg is chief economist at the European Policy Center. He says Germany will probably have the last word because any bank rescue plan needs German money.
In the end, the big issue is always, does Germany support the whole package? Because without German support, it can't work.
Erwin Collier is an economics professor at the Freie Universität in Berlin. He says that even though this crisis has been simmering for months, Germany and France are acting as though they still have time.
My real fear is, one might think the back is up against the wall, but there's still a lot of room between us and the back of the wall.
France and Germany plan to unveil a package of reforms before the G20 summit in about a month. In Berlin, I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
A couple of American economists will share in this year's Nobel Prize in Economics. Christopher Sims and Thomas Sargent are both academics, and they'll share in the $1.5 million prize. Both studied the correlation of the global economy and the way central banks and governments deal with it through policy.
Marketplace's Elisa Roth is with us now from New York with the latest on the winners and the things they've researched. Good morning, Elisa.
Good morning.
So let's talk about these winners.
Well, they're both 68. They actually worked on this stuff independently, but their research is so strongly connected that the Nobel Committee decided they should get the award together. Thomas Sargent is a professor here in New York at NYU, and Christopher Sims is now a professor at Princeton.
So what work is the committee citing? What are they talking about?
Well, in very broad terms, as you said, it looks at how anything on the economic policy side, so raising interest rates or changes in government spending, how those things affect the economy. Sargent's work takes a longer view, looking at what effect the government has. So that could be Congress and its spending decision, or the Fed and how it sets monetary policies. For example, it could be how, you know, what happens to the economy when the government sets a new inflation target. But he's also used it to explore more theoretical ideas like how a new policy could end up affecting the economy. And Sargent's research can also be used to analyze how changes in economic policy force households and businesses to adjust their behavior. Sim's work looks at shorter term, more abrupt changes. So something like whether changing the interest rates cause inflation to change, you know, to go up or down, or if the government adjusts interest rates because it thinks the inflation rate is going to change.
Now, this sounds like it has applications to the real world, right?
Oh, very much so. In fact, Dr. Sims told reporters today that this work could help us understand the current economic crisis.
I don't think my research and methods have any simple direct implication for the current situation. I think they point to ways to try to unravel why our serious problems developed.
And by the way, speaking of real-world implications, the winners say they haven't decided where they're going to invest their prize money yet.
All right. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reporting from New York. Elisa, thanks.
You're welcome.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Vast Conference, the service that gives clarity, professionalism, and flexibility for conference calls at a low price. Vast provides both regular and toll-free numbers so you can set up calls anytime, and provides web tools to manage or record calls instantly. Priced at 2.5 cents per minute with no commitments or contracts, try Vast Conference with 2 free calls at vastconference.com, promo code Marketplace. That's vastconference.com, promo code Marketplace.
Egypt's stock market was down more than 5% at the start of trading today following violence on the streets of Cairo between Muslims, Christians, and security forces.
24 people were killed in the violence. It's one of the worst cases of rioting there since last February's revolution. And that's amplified uncertainty about Egypt's economy. Reporter Julia Simon's with us now from Cairo with the latest from there. Hi, Julia.
Hi, good morning.
How has the Egyptian economy been doing lately?
Well, amidst all the violence in recent months here, there are still American investors interested, and the American Chamber of Commerce is actually promoting investment in the country. But it's still a really difficult sell. One of the things that's holding back economic growth is the Mubarak regime racked up a lot of debt. Now 22% of the country's spending goes to paying off foreign loans. And Egypt's public debt is about 80% of GDP. And with all the political uncertainty, last week, Fitch Ratings Agency downgraded Egypt's long-term credit, making borrowing even harder. And, of course, tourism's having really a lot of trouble as well.
I can imagine. I mean, how can the economy withstand all this continued turmoil and uncertainty?
Well, it's not exactly clear at this point. Back in June, Egypt's finance minister rejected a loan from the IMF for $3 billion, mainly for nationalistic reasons. Egypt's new government didn't want to be seen as being dependent on the IMF, the World Bank, and also these Gulf countries had promised a lot of money to Egypt. But now much of this Gulf money hasn't come through yet, and so the new finance minister, he's reconsidering the IMF loan. And we expect an IMF delegation to visit soon to discuss borrowing.
All right, Julia Simon reporting from Cairo. Julia, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, I don't think anyone will dispute the fact that our economy is out of sorts, Steve, certainly off its A game.
Yeah, maybe it's more like C or D game, I think is what's going on there. But whether or not we're in a recession, maybe just a technicality at this point. Fortune Magazine's Alan Sloan is with us now with his take on the whole thing. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Steve.
The economy's already in the tank. I mean, why does anyone care if we're in a recession?
Well, I don't know if people care, but the one thing I can tell you is it's going to take a long time to find out if, in fact, we're in a recession now. We won't know for probably at least a year and maybe longer.
Well, I mean, what's the official definition of a recession?
It's whatever something called the Business Cycle Dating Committee says is a recession.
That's not what it sounds like, I'm sure.
No, it is not an internet pickup operation. It's a bunch of very serious economists working out of something called the National Bureau of Economic Research.
You know, Alan, we may not technically be in a recession, but will we be sometime soon?
Who knows? Maybe we're in a recession now. You'll be glad to know that the end of the last recession, which the committee decided ended in June of 2009. They announced that in September of 2010, which was 15 months later. So ask me in 13 months whether we're in a recession now, and I'll have an answer for you.
We'll have to go to the dating committee. So,
hey, I'm a married man. You be careful.
Fortune Magazine's Alan Sloan. Alan, thanks.
You're welcome, Steve.
Steve, I want to take you back to about, a few weeks, almost a month ago, when we told you about Netflix spinning off its DVD by mail service
Quickster.
Into a website called Quickster.
Quickster.
Yes, of course. Wasn't that a great idea? Everyone loved that idea. That was really went over
well with
the customers. That way Netflix could focus on its online video streaming business. Well, today, Steve, forget that ever happened. Netflix has abandoned those plans. Here to explain is the host of the Marketplace Tech Report, John Moe. Hi, John.
Hey, Jeremy.
So tell us, what is going on with Netflix?
I think Netflix wanted to kill off discs. They're expensive to store. They're expensive to ship. They are not the future of how we will be entertained. But while Netflix was ready to do this, people weren't, and they complained. And I think Netflix heard them and had to do a reversal.
But it seems like a very strange way to run a company, to come out and say one thing, really anger the customers, then just weeks later decide you're not going to do it.
Well, New Coke seemed like a good idea at the time. The movie career of Rob Schneider seemed like it would have been a really bold move. I mean, and in technology, everyone's guessing. Everyone's guessing at what the next thing is going to be, and it's moving fast. And I think Netflix wanted to keep the goodwill of customers. I mean, it was the way to run the company, the way it was supposed to work, I think, was if Quickster started to falter, which it inevitably would because people are going to use fewer and fewer DVDs, then Netflix would have been in a position to say, all right, we're just getting rid of that line of our business. We don't need that. And it wouldn't have suffered.
Well, John, you made an interesting point when Facebook made the changes to its website, which made things more complicated for the user. And you said when you evolve with technology, it's got to become simpler. Is that the problem here? The users thought that this was more complicated.
It was more complicated. They were going to have to go to a different website, register their credit card information at a different place. I mean, ultimately, it's one more website, but still, it was simpler for Netflix to run these two parts of the business differently, but it was more complicated for the customer. The customer let Netflix know.
John Moe, host of the Marketplace Tech Report, thanks so much.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Well, Jeremy, John, the National Retail Federation says Halloween spending is up 10% over last year. Americans are going to shell out nearly $7 billion on Halloween this year, spending an average of $72 apiece, doling out candy, putting up decorations, and, of course, dressing up as something or someone that you're not supposed to be or you would like to be, maybe an alter ego in my case. Who knows? So the price comparison website, sortprice.com, says superhero costumes are among the most popular this year. Captain America, you know.
Spider-Man.
Superman. You know, those are always pretty popular year after year. But this year, the really popular ones, Angry Birds.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah, and zombies. Here in California, Governor Jerry Brown just made it easier for undocumented students to access public funds to go to college. He signed the second half of California's version of the DREAM Act, which is designed to help kids who were brought into this country illegally get educated. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has more.
22-year-old Justino Mora is a student at UCLA. He's won academic scholarships in the past, but then donors find out he's undocumented.
They call me and they tell me, look, the fact that you are undocumented, you know, we can't give you the scholarship.
The new law gives students like him access to private scholarships and public grants. It could cost the state as much as $15 million. And Helica Salas is executive director of the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights Los Angeles. She says the law ensures that undocumented students are the last to receive public funding.
They are going to have to wait until the financial need is met for U.S. citizens and people with legal status.
Unlike the federal DREAM Act before Congress, California's version does not provide any pathway to citizenship. So even if students get financial help with college, it will still be illegal for them to work in this country when they graduate. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Well, I don't know about you, Steve, but I have been hearing a lot about baseball in the last several days,
playoffs,
the last several weeks.
Man,
but
absolutely.
People are really talking about it this year. And in fact, the numbers reflect that. Last Thursday, the Tigers-Yankees game on TBS attracted 9.7 million viewers on average. That was the most to watch a League Division Series game on cable ever, and the most on any TV channel since 2005. But what do these ratings really mean for the baseball business? Now here in our podcast exclusive interview is sports reporter from USA Today, Paul White. He is with us from Arlington, Texas, where he's been covering the American League Series. Hi, Paul.
Hey, how are you?
Very good. How are you?
Good.
Let me ask you first, these ratings, they look good. Is this a trend for the whole year? Is there something different going on this year in baseball?
Well, the game you're talking about especially had the one key factor for the ratings people, and that's the Yankees. It'll be interesting to see how the ratings go from here on out with it, because the Yankees lost that game. They're eliminated. And, you know, we constantly hear from fans, how come the Yankees are on all the time? How come it's the Yankees or the Red Sox?
Because they keep winning.
And people keep watching. And, you know, I'm sure, especially Fox, which will have the World Series, is cringing over the fact that they're left with Texas against Detroit and Milwaukee against St. Louis, and two of them end up in the World Series.
So, yeah, so we're talking about smaller market. Well, smaller. I can't say that any of those are really small markets.
Right.
But Milwaukee's not a giant market.
No, Dallas is probably the best market of the four.
Yeah, so, I mean, how does that factor in? Obviously, if you got the Yankees in the division playoffs and then all of a sudden they lose and you see these numbers drop, does that happen all the time?
Yeah, it does. And it's kind of an interesting phenomenon, really. In 2000, the World Series was the Yankees against the Mets. And I think the initial reaction from the TV networks was, wow, what a bonanza.
Right.
Well, it wasn't, because the rest of the country didn't care. You need the villain. You need the big bad guy, and that's usually the Yankees. And if you can have the Yankees or maybe the Red Sox and someone to root for against the big bad guy, then you have this interesting story and people watch.
Paul, put this in a little context for us. When you compare the kinds of ratings we're seeing in baseball to, say, football or basketball, how does it rank? How does it stack up?
Well, everything's down in the TV industry. The one sort of Teflon sport, I guess, is the NFL. Hmm. Part of it is because they play once a week. There's this anticipation builds, and everybody tunes in on Sunday. But, you know, from a TV standpoint, the networks, the advertisers, the NFL is the one sure thing, and it proves it. I mean, they're making more than $20 billion.
Wow.
And their current TV contract, and baseball's national contract is a 7-year deal for $3 billion.
By the way, Steve has been drawing a picture of a baseball with his pencil. In case you heard some doodling in the background, he's getting really into it himself. America's pastime.
I'm curious, Paul, because, you know, you look at that, and whether it's big market, small market, like, I'm a lifelong Cubs fan. So if the Cubs ever went to the World Series, 104 years it would have to be now, after they won their only World – or the only World Series. No, they won a couple, I think.
A couple back in the teens.
Yeah. So I mean, would they attract – I mean, would we be talking about a big audience?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a compelling national story. You need that storyline. You know, the Red Sox had that up until a few years ago when they won. And they suddenly transformed from the lovable losers, the little engine that could, into almost the evil empire that the Yankees are. They've become the other side now.
Don't tell that to Bostonians, man.
You know, exactly, but it's true, you know. But the Cubs still have that. There's a charm. And, you know, Wrigley Field has something to do with it. But there's a national following because, you know, in this transition in broadcast, the Cubs were for a long time a national team because WGN was on cable systems everywhere. But people still recognize the Cubs. The Atlanta Braves were that way for years, too.
On TBS, yeah.
Paul White, sports reporter for USA Today. Paul, nice to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, guys.
Hey, Paul, your pick for the World Series. Who's going to win it all this year?
Oh, well, I picked the Yankees.
That's no good right now,
But I tell you, Milwaukee looks real good right now.
All right, Paul White, thanks.
No problem.
I don't know about you, Steve, but almost every time I go to the supermarket, I go to the self-checkout. Yeah. I love doing the self-checkout.
Yeah, does it make you feel important? Is that what it is? You get to scan those things?
You have control. Yeah. I don't actually
You feel trusted, too, right? Like you're not trying to
exactly.
steal anything.
That's
out
right.
Of the store. That's
right.
Good.
They
right.
give you a bit of trust. I don't feel like it's any faster per se, but it's fun.
Yeah.
And it seems like it might be the way of the future. But in fact, that is not the case. In fact, many supermarkets are getting rid of the self-checkouts altogether. Here's New England Public Radio's Ann Mastu.
The Big Y supermarket chain in Massachusetts and Connecticut installed self-checkout machines in 30 of its stores as a time and money-saving alternative to cashiers. Problem was, just 1 in 5 customers used them.
We started seeing the frustrations with customers, and then the line would get backed up.
Jeffrey Hamill is manager of a Big Y supermarket in Springfield, Massachusetts. He says customers who opt to use the self-checkout machines often have questions or problems that require a cashier's attention, basically negating their purpose. And there were the customers who just skipped the scan.
Theft was an issue. Unfortunately, you are going to have those dishonest people that were going through, and we were losing quite a bit of money in it. And the maintenance on the self-check was astronomical. We were constantly having someone come in, fix the computer chip, fix the belt. There's always an issue with the technology.
Self-checkouts caught on about 12 years ago and are still being installed in some chains. Joe Tarnowski, an editor at Progressive Grocer magazine, says about 70% of supermarket chains have tried them.
Self-checkout units cost at a minimum around $20,000 each, and that's just the basic cost of the equipment.
Big Y, like most stores, installed 4 per store. Now they're on their way out. It's the second chain in the country to pull its self-checkouts. The privately held Albertsons stores in the West and the South have removed them from all of their stores. On a recent afternoon at the Big Y in Springfield, customers are lined up in front of cashiers. The self-checkout lanes are deserted. Customer Linda Adams says she prefers buying her groceries from an actual person.
Because I think they're very courteous here, and they pack right, and I think they do a better job than me. So I'd rather wait in line 5 more minutes and get it done right.
Both Big Y and Albertsons promise to open up more checkout lanes with human cashiers. I'm Ann Mastu for Marketplace.
Jeremy, happy Columbus Day.
Happy Columbus Day.
Yes, although it might be difficult to tell in many places because really few people have the day off, including us.
Us among them. Yes.
Still, retailers are pegging big sales to the holiday. Do you notice how they do the, you know, Columbus Day sale, big Columbus Day sales? How much money will those retailers actually bring in on a Tier 2 holiday like Columbus Day? Tier 2 holiday. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
You're probably working today, but that doesn't stop retailers from trying to spin this day into a moneymaker. Marshall Cohen is the chief retail analyst at the NPD Group.
As retailers have looked every month to find a way to create a holiday so that consumers will feel the urge to spend or shop or save.
Save during Columbus Day sales of electronics. Cohen says many stores have furniture on sale for people who want to get rid of their ratty old recliners before the invasion of the in-laws during the real holidays. John Long is a retail strategist at Kurt Salmon. He says retailers will also try to get you into a new winter coat.
Probably the most important thing about Columbus Day is that it's a great transition point. So you will get customers coming in looking for some of the cold weather items, sweaters and the like.
For lots of stores, October is their third best month of the year, actually because Halloween also helps scare up sales. In Washington, where lots of people have today off, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
And finally, Steve, to the latest idea from Hollywood, a movie about the online game Farmville.
Oh, lovely.
The writers of Toy Story are reportedly working with the gaming company Zynga to put together a Farmville movie. Of course, you are familiar with Farmville because it just takes over your Facebook day after day after day.
I don't know what kind of friends you have, but my friends know better than to do that stuff on my Facebook
page. They got Mafia Wars and all that stuff, but of course it involves plowing land and harvesting crops, Farmville does. I'm not sure exactly how that's going to translate onto the big screen, but I'm sure that we will hear about it on Facebook.
We will hear it. It will be announced on Facebook, most certainly.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiotakis. Enjoy your Monday. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.